And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Once again, before we start our show, our guest is waiting. Let me mention that we have a Facebook page for Occupied Territory. So please go to the Facebook page when you get a chance. If you're on the home page for Occupied Territory, you can find it there, or you can Google Facebook and Occupied Territory. And today, we have a guest with us, and we're going to talk about the Supreme Court's fairly recent, last month, I think it was, decision on 100-year-old law in Montana that was backed up by the Montana Supreme Court about campaign financing in a specific way, which relates very closely to Citizens United. And our guest today is Mimi Murray Digby Marziani. Hiya.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I might just shorten that, but, you know, whatever. I call you Mimi. Is that all right?
Yes, that's totally fine.
Okay. Let me introduce you. Mimi is the counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center, and her work focuses on money and politics, voting rights, and legislative dysfunction. So she has a lot of work to do. In this role, Ms. Marziani litigates election law cases in federal courts across the country, including before the U.S. Supreme Court. And she plays an active role in the Brennan Center's policy advocacy efforts on these issues and leads the center's filibuster reform efforts. And she frequently writes on democracy issues and has contributed opinion editorials to U.S. News and World Report, National Law Journal, Politico, New York Law Journal, etc. And she was involved in various cases, but I'm not going to read them all here. A majority of the five judges on the Supreme Court struck down a 100-year-old Montana law prohibiting corporate election spending on, and this was, when was it, about a month ago?
Yes, the decision came out actually the same week as the healthcare decision, so it was somewhat lost in the press around that.
It got overshadowed. But basically this was clearly related. I mean, it's related by blood, in a way, to use a certain phrase, to Citizens United, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we were calling the case Citizens United, too. They're so closely aligned.
The law in Montana dates back to 1912, right?
That's right. That's right. Ever since the turn of the last century, Montana has banned corporations from spending directly to influence elections. And this is a very, very similar law to the type of law at the federal level that was struck down by Citizens United.
What interests me is, if you know something about the history, is to let us know about that. Is that why in Montana, why at that time did they have a law like that?
Well, Montana had decades of corporate capture, actually, of its government, and it was the mining industry had managed to essentially buy the legislature, as well as the press, and were truly controlling the state. And people of Montana got tired of this existence, and they fought back, and they put this law into place, which then stood until last month.
Mm. So the case, I guess, was what was relitigated, or some version of the case was relitigated about that law in Montana. The Montana Supreme Court said, it's okay with us, it's still a good law, and then the Supreme Court reviewed that, right? Is that how
that's
it worked?
Exactly right. Okay. That's exactly right. The Montana Supreme Court said, you know, we understand what the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, said in Citizens United, essentially that a state must have a compelling reason to treat corporations differently when corporations seek to spend in elections. And Montana said, you know, we get that, but we are looking at a compelling reason right here, a unique history of corporate political corruption that, you know, persists and really almost ruin the state's democracy.
But are they then
for the U.S. Supreme Court, that was not enough, unfortunately.
Well, was Montana, it wouldn't have been quite enough, would it been to, I mean, if they said up until 1912, we didn't have any control over our state, the corporations owned it, almost anybody could step in and say, well, that was 100 years ago, right? Or were they saying something else, the Supreme Court in Montana?
No, Montana Supreme Court based its decision quite heavily on this historical evidence. And as they pointed out, you know, just because there's not more recent evidence of corruption in that state, that simply means that the law is working. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean anything more than that. Many of us, you know, including the Brennan Center, who submitted amicus briefs before the Supreme Court when it was considering taking this case, we presented much more recent evidence and much of it from the federal election cycle that's happening right now to say, you know what, there's, you know, not only does Montana have this long history of corporate corruption, but we are also seeing an unprecedented flood of money in federal elections. Much of it's corporate, and a lot of it is secret, so we don't actually even know if it's corporate or not, but altogether, it is posing a grave threat to our democracy, and it warrants reconsideration of the Citizens United decision.
Maybe you could give me a little bit of a primer here. I think that's how you say that word. I always used to get it wrong.
No, I think that's right.
The primers, right? I used to say primer, obviously. But somebody like Adelson, you know, just take him as the best example, obviously. Is he taking advantage of any new laws or decisions by the Supreme Court, or could he have personally donated untold amounts of money 20 years ago to a political action committee?
Yeah, that's a great question, because this is a widespread point of confusion. So the Citizens United decision had two parts. It's best known for saying that corporations are basically just like human beings when it comes to spending money on campaign advertisements.
They have the same rights as human beings.
And the same rights, have the same First Amendment rights as human beings. The court also said, and this is a quote, actually, that independent expenditures do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. And this is important because the court has also said that anti-corruption interests are the only government interests that justify limiting spending in elections. So even though it wasn't central to the case, by saying that, and the court, you know, it's not clear if the court was making a statement of law or a statement of fact.
Or a statement of opinion.
Right. But regardless, lower courts seized upon that language and extended it, and they then struck down various limits on PACs that were only going to engage in independent spending, meaning spending that's not coordinated directly with any candidate. This created super PACs, which can accept and spend unlimited donations from Sheldon Adelson and, you know, any other run-of-the-mill millionaire.
Run-of-the-mill billionaire, right?
I think it is billionaire.
Is it John Paul Getty said, was it 30 years ago, $1 billion isn't what it used to be? I guess it isn't. You know? But
I'll take it.
It's hard for me to have these discussions in any sort of reasonable or logical way because it makes me so angry. You know the feeling, right? I mean, but a 12-year-old could see that, and of course you look at Jon Stewart or Colbert or anybody else, but like a kid could see that there is obviously a connection between a super PAC and a campaign. Now, you can go so far as to see the New York Times will actually publish the names of people who resigned 3 months ago from the advisory capacity to a candidate, and they turn up in this place. The other thing about these PACs is that they are they're charitable organizations or nonprofit organizations.
Well, so there's basically three problems you just highlighted.
Okay.
The first is that it is, fairly insane to think that a donation that doesn't go directly to me but goes to a group that is supportive of my campaign is going to be considered any differently by me once I'm elected. And my goal is to get elected. So whether you give the money to me or whether you give it to the organization run by my best friend, I don't really care as long as it goes towards advertisements, opposing my opponent. So that's number one. There's the same, corruption ability, and it's silly to think otherwise. Number two, the political realities are such that these super PACs can be considered independent under the law, but can in fact be closely cooperating with candidates, and that's what we're seeing right now in the presidential campaign. These super PACs that are so closely aligned with the campaign that they are, they're virtually inseparable. I mean, the candidates are referring to these quote-unquote independent groups as, my super PAC.
Well, yeah. I mean, and once again, sometimes there's a lot of truth in satire. It's the only time you actually may even find truth in politics is in satire these days. But, Stephen Colbert created a super PAC, I forget what it's called, Fund for Fairness Tomorrow or something, whatever. And
Creating a Better Tomorrow Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, right. Yeah. Mañana. But did the Supreme Court, in all their majesty and wisdom, actually deign to define what the limitations and restrictions were, what the definition was of independent?
No, not at all, not at all. And Congress has failed to do it, and the Federal Election Commission, which is a completely dysfunctional agency, has been absolutely incapable of issuing any rules, anything close to saying that independent must actually be independent.
Well, the Federal Election Committee, what is their authority and scope to issue rules?
They can absolutely issue regulations that would govern this very issue.
Oh, really? So they could define what exactly is a connection or an independence?
Yes, right. That could go a long way towards at least making sure that so-called independent groups are actually independent. And that would, I think that would reduce somewhat the threat of corruption. However, the FEC is notoriously dysfunctional, in large part because it was created to have three Democrats and three Republicans on its board, and particularly in an age of such polarized politics, mm-hmm. You can imagine those folks never agree on anything. So what you end up is time after time, it's a 3-3 vote, and nothing actually happens.
So there's not, like in most other places or most places where things have to get done, there's no deciding seventh vote, right?
Right. That's exactly right.
Well, that's just a setup so that nothing ever gets done.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, I hate to keep referring to these things in such almost what sounds like childish or moral terms, but it's so clearly, you're using the word silly. I'm using the word dishonest. For those people in the Supreme Court who are some of the most intelligent people in the country, right?
Right.
Although, obviously, that does not rule out other moral problems. But for them to say that as long as they are independent of the candidate, that's a kind of there's a presumed, to me, dishonesty there. They know better than that, right?
Right. I mean, it absolutely defies any sort of political common sense. And, whether or not it's conscious, I have no idea. After all, none of the members of the current Supreme Court have ever run for office.
They've all been lawyers and judges, basically, right?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. You know, another great example from Citizens United, this goes back to, on this point and goes back to something you said earlier. Although the main opinion in Citizens United was 5-4, 8 justices agreed that robust disclosure is important. And there's an entire part of that decision where Justice Kennedy talks about the importance of disclosure and of enforcing our disclosure laws and how even if there aren't limits on spending, as long as we know who's spending, we can prevent corruption. He, in saying that, he seemed to assume that our current disclosure laws were able to handle the influx of new money that came when these rules on corporations and rules on independent spending were loosened. That also was not based in reality, and instead what we've seen is a bunch of new spending and essentially a million loopholes and ways that if you don't want your identity to be made public, you can easily keep it in the dark.
But everybody benefits by this. The political reality is, I guess, that between Congress and the President of the United States, that's not a whole. I mean, there's 320 million people in this country. Now we're only talking about several hundred if we limit it to Congress and the President. They could pass a law. He could sign a law defining all sorts of things.
And, absolutely.
And, right.
You know, and to President Obama's credit and, to also give credit to particularly the Democratic caucus in the Senate, they've been really pushing for a new disclosure law. And, in fact, in 2010, this law passed the House of Representatives and got 59 votes to end a filibuster in the Senate, but that was not able to get over that 60-vote hurdle. It was a Republican-led filibuster, and it died. And unfortunately now, although the Senate Democrats have brought the disclosure bill up for a vote several times, including twice this week, they still have not been able to get over the hump of the Republican filibuster.
You know, since you mentioned the filibuster, and since it says here that you are, you know, that you focus on that sometimes, I here's another thing I don't understand. I'm not trying to be like Will Rogers, like I do, but I don't.
No.
I sort of don't understand this, but I sort of sort of like it's slightly rhetorical. But if it's 59 to 41, right? And that's a pretty, to me, that's in a presidential race, that would be a smash. That would be like, you know, a rout, right? And various other political bodies, that would be like a rout, a very popular majority. Why is it, what does it mean that they can filibuster this and kill something? If there's 59 senators against 41, why can they actually kill something? I don't get it. Why don't they just let them go on and on and on? Maybe I don't understand a filibuster. Maybe I get it from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Right.
But what is a filibuster, and how can they get away with this?
I mean, unfortunately, a filibuster is allowed by the lack of any mechanism to force a vote on a bill, except for by voting for something called a cloture.
Mm-hmm.
And without that cloture vote, you don't even have to be out on the floor filibustering. You can just say, you know, you can raise a single objection. There's all sorts of things you can do. And the majority party cannot push a measure forward until they have 60 votes for what's called a cloture. That's the only way to push it forward.
And that was there for the protection of who originally? I mean, how does that work in a good way? That was stuck in
your mind. What used to happen is filibusters were fairly rare, and this was a rule to allow the majority, to allow a supermajority to push forward a bill when there was a filibuster. But filibusters were very rare, so these were all fairly rare procedural devices. Now we see a filibuster on almost every single piece of legislation, from something that's very controversial to something that should be run-of-the-mill. As a result, what has gone from a fairly arcane procedure, the cloture mechanism, is now an everyday vote. And it has essentially turned the Senate into a supermajority institution, which, by the way, is completely at odds with our founders' intent. And I've written a lot about this, but just rest assured that when our country was created, the Senate, just like every other democratic institution, and even including the Supreme Court, right? That's not even democratic. They're not elected, but they still decide things at the end of the day by a majority vote. And the Senate, and really the abuse of the filibuster, has now created this institution in the Senate that is far from anything our founders envisioned.
Is the filibuster, how far is that set down in law? In other words, could that be changed, or does that need a constitutional amendment?
No. The only thing the Constitution says is that the Senate retains the power to set its own rules. And because there is an assumption written into the Constitution that the Senate works by majority rule, you know, it's really this cloture rule that is the exception to the norm.
So basically what happened is the culture became more poisonous. It's not the actual original system that was working okay, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it worked for years and years and years, although, you know, most of the evidence from political scientists, for a variety of reasons, I think in the modern political state, we can no longer have these rules. I mean, the rules have to be changed.
Well, since clearly, and this last 4 years, the last almost 4 years now, is the last proof anybody needs, case closed, that it has now be swung over to the other part of the, it's pivoted over to another section where it is completely manifestly unrepresentative and undemocratic. So it would be a time to pass a law, but of course the law would probably never make it past the filibuster, right?
Yes, except that there is a window based on the Constitution, but also Senate history. At the beginning of a new congressional session, and so that will be this January, on the very first day before the Senate starts to operate under its existing rules, there is a window by which a majority of the Senate can change its rules without being subject to a filibuster, just by a majority vote. And this has happened before. you know, scholars of all political stripes and leanings have agreed that this is possible. So have senators of all political leanings. And so, you know, it's really just a matter of a majority of the Senate saying, you know what, recognizing that it cannot go on in this way.
In other words, maybe change it to 52 or 55 or some alteration.
One very common sense solution is, rather than requiring 60 votes to move forward with legislation, rather than putting the burden on that supermajority vote, to put the burden back on the people who are filibustering. So to say, to continue a filibuster, you need to have 40 bodies in the Senate. Because now is, you know, I say, I'm going to filibuster, and then, you know, I go back to my home state and have 5 fundraisers while those in the majority scramble to try to get 60 people on the floor.
So what exactly is the window? Are we talking about a time limit, or what do you mean by a window?
It's the first legislative day. And
so what's to prevent that then? I mean,
well, you know, last year there were a couple of proposals and a couple of champions in the Senate for rules reform. Senators Harkin, Merkley, and Udall are probably most prominent. And there were many votes. Senator Udall had a proposal for a number of different rules changes, very common sense reforms, and that got 44 votes. Senator Merkley had a proposal that would essentially recreate the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington type filibuster.
Right.
So to sustain a filibuster, you'd actually have to be out on the floor talking. And that got 46 votes. And so that was pretty, you know, the Senate was really pushing forward. And I have to tell you, I mean, the last 2 years, it resolved itself in a so-called gentleman's agreement between McConnell and Reid, Senators Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, that essentially that they would try to work together a number of things. That has completely fallen through. So I'll tell you, I mean, keep an eye out early this January for the first legislative session. I would not be surprised at all if members of the Senate say, you know what, this is ridiculous and we're tired of this. And you know what, I hope that members of both parties join in that statement, because this isn't a matter of, you know, party alliance. This is a matter of, you know, are we going to have a Senate that can deal with its daily responsibilities, which is to address our nation's problems and to do things like pass budget appropriations. That stuff is not happening, and to confirm nominations. That stuff's not happening right now.
So, you know, when you say something like 46 votes for it, that obviously means that the majority party, some of them did not, you know, vote for it, and then it didn't
pass. Right.
So basically, that just brings me back in a big circle to the original conversation. Is obviously, everybody understands that we'd have much more stringent and much more effective campaign finance laws if the people in the Senate and the Congress, and this includes the current president in the White House and the people running for president, weren't beholden to corporations and rich people in the first place. So this is like a closed circle that the rest of us citizens, i.e. maybe saps, watch from the sideline, right? And people are very frustrated. I mean, I'm on this show, I'm on national radio on Sirius XM. I'm getting more and more calls from people all the time who are so fed up. I mean, now this whole contempt of Congress, withholding. They're so fed up with the whole thing that they don't see their vote as a worthwhile exercise anymore, that it's a meaningless joke, and they're sort of thinking of taking alternative routes. And so what do we do with Citizens United? What do we do with this kind of Supreme Court and Citizens United? Is it time for a constitutional amendment?
You know, I'm not sure it's time yet, but I will say, I'll say this. I mean, the most important thing that all of us have is our vote. And the fact that people are angry and they're paying attention and they're starting to recognize, you know, folks in Congress and inside of the Beltway who are acting in ways that do not appear to be in the public's interest, and instead appear to be in the interest of a very small sliver of our society. I mean, that's important. And, you know, we all have the power to vote people in and out of office. We also have the power to persuade other people to cast a vote in the same way. And, you know, as far as the understanding of the Constitution. You know, a constitutional amendment is one route. I mean, to be honest, I think Citizens United was wrongly decided. And maybe we didn't persuade the Supreme Court of that 2 years later with the Montana case. But, you know, members of the Supreme Court change. Sometimes, you know, you might need more than 2 years, but members of the Supreme Court, I mean, they're humans. They recognize mistakes. And I think that the more that we all keep pushing and showing the Supreme Court how wrong it was, that is another way that, you know, short of a constitutional amendment, that we can still, you know, amend the meaning or amend constitutional law as it governs all of us.
So last question then, and you're sure. Listening, if you just tuned in to Mimi Murray Digby Marziani, which is, it's so great to say that. Mimi Murray Digby Marziani, it's a wonderful name, who is counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center. And if you don't know the Brennan Center, this is a place you need to keep in touch with, sign up for updates and everything, because
we have a mailing list,
very important
Twitter account,
place.
Facebook account.
I guess the last question is, here I am talking to you, and you're bringing amicus briefs, and you're arguing this, and you're talking about people have to exercise their right to vote. Personally, yourself, when you go into the voting booth this fall, and you look at all the Democrats and all the Republicans, and you think about what the president's been doing. I mean, for instance, the Brennan Center has plenty of briefs that it's filed against the president's, pursuing whistleblowers and everything.
Right.
So here's the bottom line without making a big speech. There doesn't seem to be much choice between the two of them. So when you personally go into the voting booth in the fall, I mean, do you think it's going to make a difference if you're voting for whatever senator is a Democrat or Republican or the president even?
You know, I do think it makes a difference, but you raise an excellent point that the democratic process starts long before we all get to the ballot box on election day, and there are ways that we can actually affect the process early on, and you don't need $1 million to do it. Actually, I talk to a lot of college kids, you know, particularly in this age of new advances of communications. I mean, that's probably one of the most powerful weapons we all have. That, you know, the fact that I can sit in my apartment and make a YouTube video and try to persuade people to get behind a certain candidate or to boycott a certain company when they are, you know, spending political money in a way that I don't think is right. I mean, those are other tools that we all have within the political process.
I guess maybe that's where it's at, because of this boycott of Rush Limbaugh's advertisers, increasing the shareholder movement. I mean, so maybe there is some hope there.
You know, funders pulling out of ALEC when they didn't agree with some of the stances that organization was taking. You know, people are starting to pay attention, and I am personally. I think it is an incredibly positive development.
All right. Listen, I appreciate your coming on. And once again, I urge everybody to go to the Brennan Center. It's B-R-E-N-N-A-N, named after my favorite judge, Justice Brennan, and who wrote the best dissents anybody ever wrote. And it's the Brennan Center. I think it's the Brennan Center for Justice, is it called?
The Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law.
Okay, and check it out online, and it's one of the places you have to be tuned into. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye.
This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Once again, I hammer you over the head in the most unsubtle way. Go to the Facebook page, Occupied Territory. You can click on it on the Occupied Territory homepage, and we have a new feature here today, you know? You know, like on TV all the time, they used to say every other day, new, you know, with giant exclamation marks, you know, because they put some other poison in Tide, so it was new. But we have an actual really good new feature here at PRN.FM. It's on the home page, on the front page there. It's click to call. And you just go over there and you'll see it. It's very prominent, I'm told. And you put your name in, you put your phone number, and bam, all you have to do is click. You don't have to even use your index finger. You don't even have to use it for anything. Or if you're using it for something else, you can only have to use it for a second for this. You put your name in and you put the phone number in, and boop, you hit the thing. And we get a call right away, and you can tell us whatever words of wisdom you have. Let's see. Let's take a break, and we will come back. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. And now you may get used, you may want to use the click to call button. It's funny, I had a discussion the other night with somebody who is a member of the radio staff and talked about the difficulty of reading things on the radio. On the radio, it always sounds better if somebody's talking spontaneously, like I am now talking to you spontaneously. And if you read something on the radio, it's tricky. People who are professional actors who have been reading on the radio, like announcers for a long time, can actually, I knew one guy on the radio, a previous radio station, who for 35, almost 40 years, reads almost everything he says on the air, and some of it is extensive, and it's sort of interesting subject matter, but it sounds like he's talking. He happens to be a lawyer who litigates in court, so maybe he has the trick of doing that, or if you're an actor. And I often don't read myself because I'm not such a good reader. I'm a better, you know, stream of consciousness talker, although I'm not always so logical or sequential. But reading is something I usually don't do. But here's something I want to mention. And I've been mentioning this on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. And you may want to check up some of these things. And we have a call. Ask them to hold on for a second because I just wanted to, you know, get this out. One thing that I brought up, and one thing I brought up on Sirius XM Radio, where I have the national show, and this is a national show too. I don't know why I keep making that distinction. They're all national shows. For the last couple of years, after Obama got in the beginning, when President Obama got in, I, like everybody else who voted for him, and even though I had a pretty sober attitude about where he came from, he was a professional politician. He rose suspiciously fast in the ranks. He was backed by moneyed people. You know, one of the owners of the owner of the Hyatt hotel chains was the person who literally made him U.S. senator and almost made him president. And she's not such a wonderful person. So the guy was, you know, a politician. He was a member of the Democratic Party majority. He was vetted by rich people, you know, who run everything. But then when he got in and started appointing Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner, and then later on this happened and that happened, and despite all the good things he did, I feel like it's my job on the radio. You know, people are writing to me all the time because I talk about voting for a third party. I'm fed up with both parties. Obviously, you can hear that. And if you listen to me regularly, you know that I'm really fed up with both of them, that I feel like they're both almost indistinguishable from each other. They're both in the pocket of the rich. Obviously, if the Democrats could get their way and they could have a supermajority, things would be better than if the Republicans, you know, had a supermajority. Or if, you know, since Obama has done some good things, or sometimes even we might call it many good things, I think he's done a lot of bad things. And for me personally, the bad outweighs the good. I feel like it's my job when I'm on the radio here as a journalist, especially somebody, I don't like labels, but who's supposed to be on the left and who's supposed to be somebody who takes the First Amendment seriously. My job as a journalist, as a radio talk show host, as a journalist, whatever you want to call me, as a commentator, as a citizen, my job as an American citizen, and the same as your job, your responsibility, is when the emperor has no clothes or when the emperor starts stepping on you, no matter how charming he is or how intelligent he is or whatever words he uses for folks all the time, it doesn't matter. If somebody is signing bills into law that permit the U.S. Army to patrol the streets of New York and lock you up because he decided you're a terrorist without any evidence and doesn't have to show you the evidence, lock anybody up, throw you in jail forever, no habeas corpus, no key. The president signed a bill, the National Defense Authorization Act, as part of a budgetary thing for the Defense Department a few months ago. And one of the articles in there, one of the subdivisions of the bill, which he asked for, he wanted the power, is to do just that. He basically signed a bill which effectively made him a dictator and took away habeas corpus. It violated every major democratic rule and ethic that we've lived by. And this guy, to me, is a tool of rich people. He is, like, once again, I'll say it again. He has done many good things, but he's done far many worse things. And people are dead as a result of things he's done. There's no excuse for it. He's sent tens of thousands of extra troops to Afghanistan to look like a man and to get votes and to look like a strong president because he wanted to get reelected again. And yet, thousands of people had died or had their lives destroyed by his behavior. And he's taken our tax money and never asked Congress, there's no declaration of war, of course, and done this. Now, I don't want to go down the whole long list of things he's done. It's an endless list of things. The man, to me, has increased the executive power to the point where it's past the point where even Bush took it, and he's made it into a dictatorship. And I feel like I would be irresponsible and even unpatriotic, and I wouldn't be doing my job as an American, let alone a radio commentator, if I didn't point this out. If it was when it was Bush, I was pointing it out. And I was it was body blows and shots to the head every week because I felt like he was letting democracy down, that he didn't represent anybody, you know, who I knew even vaguely resembled an American citizen. And I don't feel a whole lot different about this guy. He's just one more rich guy who wants to increase his power. And I could go down the whole long list, but I won't. And I've been having so many arguments with people when they call up on the phone and when they send me emails. I've been on a radio almost 34 years. I have never seen people. I've interviewed 1,000 people, right? I have commented on everything. I've told stories. I've done sort of artistic radio. I've done political radio. I have never had so many people so riled up and so many people getting in touch with me and arguing with me as about this one issue, because I will constantly have third-party candidates on. And I'm urging people to vote for third-party candidates because Obama is corrupt. Oh, yeah, Romney is worse. True, but I am sick to death, and I will never again personally vote for the lesser of two evils. I'm sick of being part of that. I don't want to be part of the lesser of two evils because it makes you evil, even if it is the lesser of two evils. I won't do it anymore, and I urge people not to do it too. And I'm getting the most astounding. It's just ironic to me that all these decades on the radio doing extraordinary things, if I say so myself, then I'm getting more listeners and more response because people want to chop my head off. They'll say, what they're saying basically is, you're going to lose the election because you're a purist and a radical idealist and you have no sense of the way the grown-up world works. Look what Nader did. He lost the election for Gore, right? And now you want to do it again because I keep urging people to vote for the Green Party or Rocky Anderson is on the Justice Party. I will not push a button or pull a lever for a man like Barack Obama and the crew that he represents with his kill lists and his approving Arctic drilling and his keeping Guantanamo open and God knows whatever the hell else he's doing. And I seem to have a pretty long list here. It's 3 pages long. But I won't do it. And people are angry at me. The argument has been shifted to the Occupied Territory Facebook page. Feel free to go there and engage me. We're having lively arguments. Some of them devolve into actual threats. But that's democracy, right? So if you want to call up, why don't you use the new call, the new click-to-call. Click-to-call. We call it C2C. C2C button here at PRN.FM. Moving forward every second so fast that you can't keep up with us. Click-to-call. Fill in your name. Write your telephone number. Includes the area code. Am I right, Mr. Engineer? And then you click-to-call. Do we have somebody on the line? Well, put them on, please. Thanks. Dave, you're on.
Okay.
Sorry for the speech, Dave. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, great. I agree with you 100,000%, let's say, on the Obama thing, which I'll talk to about it in a second. This Alec thing, We just learned about it, what, this last year or something. My sister's a politician down in Texas, and she takes 10 pages of Google when you look her up. At any rate,
She's
been around for a long, long time.
Right. Is she a state level politician?
She's a comptroller.
Oh, okay.
And she said Alec has been around for a long, long time. Now my question is, why the hell hasn't someone brought this thing up instead of just so recently? That's the question. Now I want to chime in here about Obama before I get off the air here.
Yeah, no rush.
I argue with my wife about it. I think Obama is probably the worst president we have ever had in this country.
And your reason?
Ulysses was a Grant worse than anybody.
Well, why is he worse than Bush, for instance?
What did Bush do? He got us into Iraq.
That's pretty bad.
Bush did a lot of things. He got the Supreme Court to elect him and all this stuff.
Right.
And he put these horrible people on the Supreme, his father, rather, Mr. Thomas especially, and Scalia. But this Obama is, like you say, a dictator. I mean, he passes these laws that get rid of the 1,000-year-old, or 2,000, how old is it, 1,000 years old, the thing about the English king, you know, the nobles.
The Magna Carta.
Magna Carta, bring the guy before me. What was it? You just said the word in Latin.
Well, it's habeas corpus, which literally means in Latin, you know, here is
bring me the guy or something.
Right, produce the body, the person.
Produce the body.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this guy's unbelievable, and no one seems to mind. No Democrat seems to even understand what's going on. And the guy, everything he said, just about 100% of the things he said before he got elected, is a complete lie. And one was even proven, the thing about NAFTA, how he's going to change NAFTA, then he sends somebody up to Canada and said, don't believe that bullshit. I'm just saying that for political reasons.
Well,
to them.
No, he didn't change NAFTA. Not only that, he's, I don't remember the exact acronym or the title of it, but this sort of like what East Asian Treaty something. He's creating an Asian
TPP.
NAFTA now. Yeah.
No, TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is vastly worse. And apparently one person wrote an article saying this is the last agreement because other people can join it now, China and so forth.
Well, you know, but here's the question, right? I mean, you know what the Republicans are like, and you know what Romney's like. I mean, Romney, there's nobody I could think of who's...
My sister's one of them, but she's nice, and she's good, and even Democrats vote for her.
Well, here's the question that I mentioned before. If I say vote for a third-party candidate because these two people are corrupt, and basically they're essentially liars and murderers, if not thieves, to two of them, and I'm talking about Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, people are accusing me of losing the election for Obama, and then I would be responsible because of that attitude for putting Mitt Romney and the worst of the Republicans in by telling people to vote for a third party candidate. So what's your opinion about that?
I don't know. What am I supposed to do? Say I should have voted for Nader? I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I physically cannot push my hand to the button to vote for Mr. Obama this next time.
That's exactly the way I feel.
Yeah.
I can't do it either. It's a matter of...
My arm won't go forward. It will just not do it.
I know.
And I think he's the worst president we've ever had. This guy's attacking the Constitution up and backwards and forwards and left and right. And he, of course, he taught it, so it's even worse because he knows what he's doing. He's not, you know, like Bush.
Well, I don't see him as the worst president we've ever had. The way I see it is that Bush was, to me, George Bush is the worst president that we've ever had in terms of lying and the two wars, especially the war in Iraq, which was based on
everything he said is a lie. Mm-hmm. Obama, he's worse than Bush. Wars we've had before. We have wars all the time. We love these wars, Americans. But this guy, everything he said before the election is a lie. He's done the opposite when he gets in.
Mm-hmm. I can't.
I remember one thing about Bush that was kind of interesting. Every time that he would bless some program,
mm-hmm.
He'd say, "This is the most wonderful program." Blah 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 blah. The next day, the very next day, within 24 hours, he would destroy it.
Well, that's what
over and over he would do that.
All right, so I'm gonna have to move on, and I want to comment on what you're saying and amplify this a little bit. But I appreciate your calling in. But so have you gone to this Facebook page, Occupied Territory? Are you?
No.
Do you have access to the computer? I mean,
yeah, of course.
Okay, so just go to just put in if you go to.
Hey, by the way, I don't like your push button thing. I tried it, and it's just too much work.
Is it really? So it's easier just to call up.
Yes.
Okay. You know, whatever. I mean, I'm probably closer to your age. I mean, I dial phones, and I think it would be a strange thing to do. On the other hand, I could see the alternative being kind of, because I wonder if it's an automatic thing. Maybe my,
you got to type your name in. Then you got to type your phone number in. Then after that, you said, God, this is more work than I wanted. Then you have to choose. I said, at that point, the hell with it. When this big long list comes out and I got to choose a topic, or choose you, I guess, out of some list, screw it.
All right. Listen, thanks for calling. And we're going to get our technical guy who is in charge of this kind of thing. He's going to comment on this right now. So thanks. Why don't you hang up and hear what he has to say? Okay. Now, the click to call is, I suppose, it's something that's being used in various different places. And the only advantage I can see to it myself is that if it's an automatic thing, in other words, if it remembers you, and you don't have to do it each time. Otherwise, I don't know exactly how it's an advantage over actually having the phone number and then actually dialing it. But maybe you can tell me.
Well, the advantage is that if you don't want to punch out the keys on your phone at home.
But you got to punch them there anyhow, right?
I mean, well, you can type them in, yeah.
Yeah, but if, yeah.
So if you're a listener and you're, say, you know, on your laptop, you got your cell phone in your pocket, maybe you're eating lunch, you know, at Starbucks,
mm-hmm.
All you have to do, instead of having to take out your phone and copy down the little numbers on your little laptop.
So you call on the computer.
Yeah,
right.
you're doing one thing. Here's the thing, though.
Okay.
It's not even about doing one thing or the other. It's all about convenience. You can choose how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not taking up much space on the website.
Right.
And it's your choice. And not only that, it calls you. That's kind of convenient, I feel.
So, like, if you were carrying, let's say, a smartphone around or something like that, you could just go bang, 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 and that's it, and then the call goes through. You don't have to...
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, if you have our mobile app, which is available at prn.fm/mobile,
mm-hmm.
There's actually just a one-click button that takes you to whichever phone you're using, iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, Windows Mobile, any of those phones, right on the front menu, on the home menu in our app, you just click a button and it calls right in. Goes
okay.
Right to your dialer. So there's a lot of different options, and that's the idea.
Okay, so what we have is an extra option. So in other words, anything more or makes it easier or an additional thing that makes it easier to call is better. So that's what we have. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
I have to have a talk with the Munchkins, who live in Oz out here outside the radio studio. They need a little talking to. We'll do that another time. But I'm just going to wind up here in the last couple of minutes. This is Mike Fader. This is Occupied Territory. I don't think that Obama's a worse president than Bush. This is the way I see it. There has been an increase in executive power to the point where we do have something that has gone past the point of maybe being a dictatorship to actually having a semi-dictatorship in this country. The usurpation of executive power, which I'm going to talk about at length some other time and bring some guests on, has gone too far. And it started during World War II and continued, and it's never stopped. Democrat, Republican, nobody has gone backwards on this. They keep going forwards on this, and it's bad for all of us. When Congress went after Eric Holder, and they said he was in contempt of Congress, the president is in contempt of Congress. Every president, Democrat or Republican, for the last 40 years has been in contempt of Congress. They just happen to represent the people of the United States, i.e., presidents are in contempt of democracy and they're in contempt of Congress. So when Obama does even worse things than Bush, he's building on a giant pile of anti-democratic behavior. And that's what makes him, in a way, not worse than Bush, but he's just adding to it. So he's the latest example of something that's gone very wrong. And I do think the man is a liar. I think he's an opportunist. And I think he's done a lot of things that are going to do nothing but hurt democracy. And I got no use for him. And there's much more I could talk about in terms of how I feel about him. But it's the increase in executive power. He uses signing statements. He asks for bills that give him power. He doesn't deserve in a democracy. He is no longer the president of the United States. He is the dictator of the United States. And I don't mean him personally. It's not racist. I'm not a Republican. I know that the Republicans are generally worse and Romney would be worse than him. It's just building on this abuse of executive power to the point where he might as well put on a military uniform like in some third world dictatorship and carry a baton and say, I just made a law. You better shut up and do it or else. That's how close we are. That's why I'm going on about him. That's why I would never vote for him. Meanwhile, if you want to participate in this and yell at me, feel free to do it online at Occupy Territory on the Facebook page. And now we go to our closing theme, and we'll be back next week with more exciting radio.